Gentlemen of the Commonwealth Club of California, next Monday, the German ambassador, Karl Knapstein, will speak here at this hotel to the Commonwealth Club. Many of you noticed that as you came in, the ticket booth was open for next Monday's luncheon. His subject will be one of tremendous interest, namely Berlin and its significance in the German foreign policy, a worthwhile subject. A week from today, next Friday, our speaker will be Brigadier General Hittel, and his topic, Communist Strategy in Cuba and in the Far East, also a very timely subject. Our speaker today, Governor Brown, is going to speak on the subject, the legislative program and the state's economy. He and I agreed that for me to take time to give you a biography of the governor would be foolish, because you're here to hear him and not to hear me. I want to point out to you, however, that this will be his sixth appearance before the Commonwealth Club, and that he follows the tradition of Governors Knight, Warren, Merriam, and Young, all whom addressed the Commonwealth Club during the time the legislature was in session. Gentlemen, it's a distinct privilege for me to present to you our distinguished Governor, Edmund G. Brown.
Thank you very much, George Dean. I appreciated fulsome introductions before and during the campaign. Now they're not quite so important. Justices of the Supreme Court, Justice of the Municipal Court, two of whom I had the honor of appointing at the speaker's table, Dr. Callison, my old friend, my fellow San Franciscans and fellow Californians. California is on the threshold of greatness. For 60 years, the hard work of the Commonwealth Club has been helping the state achieve that high position. The results include progressive laws in banking, budgeting, criminal justice, water, civil rights, hospitals, and highways. And still, as one of your members said, you have not run out of menaces. Neither has the state of California. Today is in the past. It's a pleasure to discuss with you not only the menaces and the perils, but the promise of California's historic expansion. Since we met last April, events of historic importance have taken place in California. And this does not refer particularly to the referral of my contract on November 6th, although it is of great historic importance to me, I can assure you. It does refer to California's new position as the nation's number one state. We take pride in that leadership, but it is not pride in mere bigness or material resources. Since I've taken off 18 pounds, I can assure you that there's no virtue in fat. Population alone does not make a state or a nation. The great issues are, what have we done? What are we going to do? What should we do? Now let's look briefly at what we've done to advance the state in the past 4 years, a period in which California was challenged by the greatest mass migration in the history of the world. First, the California Water Plan. After years of paralyzing stalemate, we got moving. Today, the dirt is flying at Oroville Dam and the San Luis Project, as I talk to you today. The first surplus water of the Delta has already been delivered to northern areas of need. The Supreme Court has just endorsed the good judgment of the people in moving ahead with this very bold project. The way is now clear for the state to stay right on schedule in every phase of this project. By June, we expect to sell the first bonds to keep the project moving. Second, education. Can you name another state or another country that is built or is building 9 institutions of higher learning, 6 new state colleges, 3 new campuses of the University of California, a new medical school, a new dental school? And we've started all of these things in less than 4 years. We're proud that we have more Nobel Prize winners on our faculties than are to be found in the entire Soviet Union. And not for an instance do we forget that California receives more than 41% of America's space age research contracts because of the scientists that we're attracting to our institutions of higher learning. But our progress is costing money. It is not cheap. But I consider the investments that we're making, and I'm sure that there is not a person in this room that doesn't feel that the investments that we're making in higher education in this state are blue-chip investments of the highest order. Third, in mental hygiene. We've invested money in research and in the application of new techniques. And you might say that this was costly. It certainly is not cheap. But what are the results? We've cut down the number of people in our institutions and reduced the need to build a multi-million dollar mental hospital. In fact, California's mental hospital population, and just think of this, has declined 2,500 in the past 4 years, although the total state population increased by 2 million. This too, my friends, was a good investment. Fourth, in narcotics. We've developed a treatment center that cure patients in many cases and permit new treatment in the community and in the home. We're investing money in the new narcotic hospital at Narco, and this is not an inexpensive project either. But it will, in the long run, rehabilitate the addicts, save lives, and save the taxpayers' money, too. We have conservation camps that we'll open this year up in the northeastern part of our state, and we're building other ones down in Tuolumne County, where we'll not only conserve the minds and the bodies of these people committed to these institutions, but we'll conserve the great natural resources of our state. Now, these are just a few of the examples of what we've accomplished in the short space of 4 years. There were many other breakthroughs, too. The first master plan for highway development, the first air pollution control laws, the first economic development agency to draw new industry to our state, the first comprehensive state program for cancer research, the first laws to permit retraining workers who must upgrade their skills in this technical age. Every last one of these actions, and many more, have pumped vitality into the economy of our state, directly or indirectly. And here's the proof in 1963. Personal income is still breaking records. Last year, it reached a rate of $49.2 billion, 7.9% over the year of 1961, a large increase over the national average. Employment this year reached an all-time high for January, and it appears that February will break all records, too. Unemployment is still too high and fluctuates seasonally, but we expect in the long run to continue to force it down. It's a little bit less this month than it was this same month a year ago. Farm income should exceed $3 billion for the 5th consecutive year. And in farm income, however, we have some tough problems on the common market, and we're working on that too, but I can't go into that today. Retail sales are reaching record highs. Last year's total was 8% above the previous year. Those are some of the reasons why businessmen poured hundreds of millions of dollars into our economy through new investment and expansion in 1962. And there's another compelling reason for our good business climate, although you may not hear so much about this. You've had good government in California, good government at the state level, good government at the local level. For 4 years, we've been guided by uncompromising principles of fiscal responsibility. And that, too, is on the record. Now, you've heard me before describe in the past the condition of the California Treasury when I became governor in 1959. When my old friend Bert Levitt joined me in Sacramento in November of 1958, when we planned the first budget of this state, we found a state government that had been financing current expenses from capital funds, a state government plunging toward a deficit of $268 million in 18 months. If that course had not been checked, the state would have had to have issued warrants to pay its bills. And you would have, I can assure you, seen a flight of industry from our state. You would have seen a higher cost in the bond market in the bonds that California must sell. With the support of public and responsible members of the legislature in both political parties, we reversed that trend. We insisted that the state could and would live within its income. We secured new revenues to make up the inherited deficits. And I just hate to think where we would have been if we had not sought new revenues in 59 and not had them given to us by the legislature of this state. And from that day on, we have not permitted one penny of deficit spending in Sacramento. Now, these actions set the stage for the great campaign of 1962. During that campaign, I made a series of speeches which proposed 10 points for progress in California. And let me say right here, every commitment that I made during that campaign, during the 13 months of that campaign, were included in my inaugural message in 1963. I took the speeches that I made throughout the state, and I called through them. And then before we made those speeches, we wanted to know that we were within the realm of possibility, that they were things that we could do in this state. And then we moved ahead. And in the inaugural message that I delivered on January 6th of this year, those points were all covered. A pledge to me, a pledge made to the people, is regarded as a sacred trust. And I intend to the limit of a governor's ability to keep every single commitment that I have made. In that campaign last year, I promised the people of California that at no sacrifice of needed programs, we would continue to submit balanced budgets. And on January 31st, I sent my fifth balanced budget to the legislature of this state. In that campaign, I promised the people of California that there would be no new taxes this year in the 63-64 budget. And there are no new taxes in our proposed budget for 63-64. And do you remember the stories and the outcries of some that it was impossible to do? And before the budget was submitted, the statements that were made that I must have new taxes. Of the total budget, $3.25 billion, and this is an awful lot of money, my friends, only less than 3%, $83 million, represents program not already approved by the legislature or the voters. One-third of this increase that we've suggested in this budget will go to local school support. And please note this well. The total includes an automatic addition of about $135 million, or 4.6%, just for California's growth and rising costs. When you have more children in your public schools, under the Constitution of the State of California, the state must put more money in the budget every year. And when you have 213,000 more youngsters in September of 1962 than you had in September of 1961, and you know you're going to have the same number in September of 1963, you can do nothing but put that money in the budget to take care of these youngsters that are coming along. Capital outlay projects are almost all for growth in the fields of water and education and subventions to local government for education, health, welfare, and flood control. These growth pressures, my friends, are great, and they will not grow less in the years ahead. Now, what are the prospects in revenue producing to pay these bills? California's economy will continue to outpace the nation in rate of growth, and the long-term prospects are excellent. Nevertheless, it is estimated that in 1964-1965, collections will leave a gap of $150 million between revenues and expenditures if we make no changes in our revenue system. Now, at first glance, it might seem that the governors of California and New York are facing similar problems in 1963. We both pledged no new taxes in the 1962 campaign. I think he pledged no new taxes during the 4 years of his administration. I know that I pledged no new taxes just for 63-64, which was as far as I could anticipate ahead in the projections that we made. And this year, the governor of the second largest state in the union is trying to persuade his state that a $48 million increase in auto registration fees, which for 4 years his budget called taxes, and a $57 million increase in liquor license fees are considered within the pledge that he made. Now, as a member of the governor's union, I want you to know that I'm not making any criticisms of any other governor. I have a few of my own that I have to take care of. I'm merely doing it so that you can see the relationship between the state that is comparable to California. The New York Times has commented, "We fully agree with the necessity of both of these tax proposals, but let no one be fooled into thinking that they're not new taxes." Now, how do we propose to close the gap between revenues and expenditures in California in 64-65? Well, we have a little different story. We're proposing two basic tax reforms to remove existing inequalities that now tend to penalize present taxpayers. First, after January 1, 1964, we propose to eliminate the option of paying the personal and corporation income tax in installments after the date that the tax is due. Second, we propose a payment of tax out of current income by relatively minor weekly or monthly payroll deductions. Now, let me emphasize this because I don't think this is made clear, that the withholding tax will not start in the 63-64 budget that I presented to the legislature a month ago, but it will be in the 64-65 budget if the legislature this year adopts the proposals that we have made. We further propose a forgiveness of one-fourth of the tax on the 64 personal income when the return is filed in 1965. Corporations, too, will pay on current income rather than on the prior year's earnings. Now, let me make very clear the distinction between these proposals and the new fees which Governor Rockefeller has asked in New York. One, no new tax liability will be imposed on anyone who does not already have a tax liability under the law of the state of California at the present time. Two, the state will follow tax deduction and reporting procedures now used by the federal government and 26 other states. There is neither an increase in tax rates nor an extension of the tax base itself. Three, in fact, in other legislation that we will recommend, we will cancel the income tax of less than $5 for single individuals and less than $10 for a husband and wife with two children. Fourth, we further propose to return $85 million to individuals through forgiveness of the one-quarter of what is owed in 1964. Banks and corporations will be given a credit of $65 million. These proposals, my friends, are already under a slight attack. Nevertheless, Nevertheless, I assure you that they will hold up under the closest scrutiny. They deserve your support because it is you, the taxpayers of this state, who are penalized by the existing inequities. And let me just point it out to you. A man who moved to California in January of 1963 would immediately start using our state resources, sending our children to our schools, but he would not pay any income tax at all until April 15th of 1964. Even then, he could pay in two installments after the date when the tax is due, with no additional penalty and with no interest at all. The state would not receive its first payment for 15 months, nor its final payment for 24 months. Yet it'd be paying the school bill, the health bill, and perhaps the hospital bill for that family for two whole years. Now, you're all successful business and professional men in this room, or most of you, I assume. Could you keep your shipping company or your newspaper or your department store in business on such a basis? Could you wait 2 years to receive your medical or your legal fees? You could not. And it's no more logical to expect such patients on the part of the state of California, particularly a state that has the dynamic growth that this state has, 600,000 to 650,000 people a year. Another thing, this irregular flow of revenues forces the general fund to borrow from special funds, and these funds are placed at high interest rates, and we lose that interest during the period that we have to borrow. That is a waste of money which the state of California can ill afford to pay. Some critics have argued that withholding will produce only a one-time windfall of no long-range benefit. That argument, too, is absolutely false. Our best estimates show that recurring benefit of withholding with other revenue reform proposals will be $58 million a year. And at least $10 million, and just think of this, will come from citizens citizens who do not pay one thin dime of taxes at the present time. This includes the many thousands who come into California, earn money, work here for 6 months or a year, then leave California without filing an income tax return. Their fair share of taxation, the money it costs to serve them with courts, the schools, and the hospitals while they're in this state, is paid by you and by the other responsible California taxpayers. Now, some of the criticism that I've read about is that we're merely trying to stave off the possibility of a state tax increase for 2 years. Are we trying to do that? I certainly say we are. Is there anything wrong with trying to stave off a tax increase for a period of 2 years, my friends? If we're finding ways to close the gap in this period of surging growth, should we apologize for it? Let me give you some examples of what this additional $58 million obtained through our tax reforms can do for California. $58 million will more than pay the whole cost of public health, including aid to crippled children, hospital construction, and aid to local health departments in this state. $58 million would be a substantial help in our efforts to solve the problems of smog and housing that now threatens our great cities. Another $58 million would solve our fire prevention and fire control provisions for a period of more than 2 years. Now, those are the proposals that I made to the legislature of this state. Now, how do they stack up against alternatives? On the one hand, we adopt the tax reforms, we close the loopholes, cut out the inequities, and obtain a continuing $58 million annually. Given a pickup in the economy, and we will have that probably not until this baby crop that came along after the Second World War, those born in 45 and 46, in 68, when they begin to get married, our economists tell us that we can anticipate a big growth in our economy. We will have substantial new income from our tideland oil reserves that we won some time ago, and we stand a fair chance. I want to make it very, very clear that I cannot project ourselves ahead for a period of more than really 1 year, but to anticipate it for a period of 2 years. There's a chance that we'll need no new taxes in 65-66. On the other hand, if we reject the tax reforms, we're almost certain to need new taxes in 64-65, perhaps on additional personal income, on the business or corporations, or on other major parts of our economy. There's also, of course, and I know that you will say this, the possibility of cutting back services. And that's just another way of saying, if we can, bring California's progress to a screeching halt. I wish I could go into the budget procedures in Sacramento so that you could see when I tell you that there is not a state in the Union that every agency of the state is scrutinized like it is in Sacramento, first by the Department of Finance of our state, then by the legislative analysts, then by the Assembly Ways and Means Committee, then by the Senate Finance Committee, and then again the governor at the time with the blue pencil veto that the Commonwealth Club supported so many years ago. Regardless of partisan differences, I don't believe that when the options are understood, that there's a person in this room, well, that's going pretty far. I better not go that far. I'll settle for just one vote more. Who would not take up the option that we've had to make up there in Sacramento. Most of us agree that unless we act now, our great cities will be in a state of chaos within a period of 10 years. Tomorrow I talk to the Bay Area group on the planning that we've been moving ahead on in 4 years and the things that we're doing in the planning department of the state of California. I can't go into that today either. Most of us agree that unless we act now, the beauty of this state can be lost in this great tidal wave of new residents. And I think at all times of 18 years from now, I try to project myself and my thinking up there in Sacramento of 1980 within this state when we have 30 million people in California. I think of the automobiles on the roads. I think of the crowded condition of our cities. I think of all of the things that we've undertaken and the things we've done in the past 20 years in anticipation of this growth. And then I think of 12 million more people, 30 million more people in this state. And I tell you, with all of the vehemence and with all of the experience of 19 years in public life, that we have to invest in the future of this state. We have to do it exactly the same as the Pacific Gas and Electric Company is doing when they announced yesterday that they intended to expend some $2.5 billion to take care of these growth problems. And Mr. Dean of the telephone company, and they move ahead in those things. And you don't find criticism before the idea has even been, before it's even gotten warm. In one of the newspapers this morning, a newspaper that has fought our water project from the time that we started, a new finance program before it's even given the light of day, we find out that somebody is going to pull something over on the people of our state, and they can always get some legislator up there in Sacramento, someone in the opposition, that will shoot from the hip. And there we are in controversy. I tell you that we have to objectively look at these things. There is not a single thing that I propose to the state of California that in any degree is partisan whatsoever. These are not philosophic questions, my friends. These are housekeeping jobs in the state of California. Most of us agree that we must continue to support our world-renowned system of tuition-free higher education, Most of us agree that it's better for the state to make possible open-heart surgery for a sick child than to let the child die without the crippled children's services. No, we don't want to cut back on those services. We don't want to cut back on the economic development activities which will tell the world that California will have 6 million new customers in the next decade. We don't want to. We cannot stop dead in our tracks. But whatever the decision of the legislature, you can rest assured, my friends, that the budget will be balanced. My blue pencils have sharp points. However reluctantly I may have to cut out services, if there is not a proposal that produces a balanced budget, I will blue pencil those items. Now today, and I'll just take 1 or 2 minutes more, and this is, I really feel that I want to talk to the Commonwealth Club on this. Today we ask your support of another urgent proposal affecting the entire tax structure in this state. Long ago, we substituted electric light for coal oil lamps. We've long ago traded the Surrey with the fringe for the jet age airplanes. Yet our tax structure at all levels, city, county, and state, has not changed since the opening decade of this century. The result is that our system places too great a share of the burden on the local property taxpayer. That burden is distributed unfairly, and local government turns more and more to the state for help in paying for services which they themselves regard as the province of home rule. We're therefore asking the legislature to join in establishing a tax commission, joint legislative executive, to make a full review of our tax structure. Their recommendations for reforms and revisions should be made before the 1964 general election, so that if constitutional amendments are necessary, they can be presented to the people. Finally, let me emphasize that in every program, we are realistic about our tight fiscal circumstances. These schools, for example, can really make a good case for increased local aid of $115 million beyond the $48 million required by law. But we are requesting in this budget that I've spoken of only $30 million because that's all that we can afford. We're trying to tying our request to a proposed program of countywide equalization that will produce $25 million a year and at the same time relieve the local property taxpayer. Similarly, the State Personnel Board, and the State Personnel Board is appointed for 10 years. One of them was appointed by Governor Warren, one was appointed by Governor Knight, and these are the people that make a factual study of salaries both in public and private employment. And they sat down with me, told me that they could justify $62 million in new salary increases if applied throughout our system. We feel that our employees are, in some of the categories, entitled to an increase for the same reason that you increase salaries in private industry. But we've reduced that amount to $30.7 million. That's all that we can afford. But I have the pressures in the preparation of this budget from the university, from the state colleges, from the professors, from the employees, from mental health, from all of these groups coming in, and we have to make those hard decisions, and then they're reviewed by the legislature of this state. My friends, we hear people ask, why is government costing so much money? The answer is that we are providing a level of governmental service unmatched in the nation and at a lower cost than is paid by taxpayers in states that offer inferior services. In the last decade, California's tax burden has dropped from a position of 19th among the other states to, in 1963, where we're 31. Our net debt of $2.68 per $100 of personal income is 33 among the states and compares to an average of 404 of all the states of this union. People pay taxes to government so that government can build schools, construct freeways, set up water programs, finance mental health clinics, and build new tuition-free universities and colleges. Those actions have helped to develop our dynamic economy, our high standard of living, our national leadership in business and farming. We must, I repeat, continue to build for the future, and we must do so on a foundation of sound fiscal policies. The obligation of a California governor is to plan, act, and move ahead so that we may preserve the values that have brought California greatness. My administration will continue to do exactly that. And if this involves controversy here and there, why, then we must meet it, and we must meet it head on. California has come to represent to the rest of the nation what the United States has long meant to the world. Through our joint effort, let us keep our state in that magnificent position. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Governor Brown, for a very inspiring talk. It's a good thing, ladies and gentlemen, that we did start a little bit early because, as you can see, the pile of questions in front of Dr. Callison is pretty high. And now, as our custom, we'll have a question and answer period conducted by our club president, Dr. Callison.
Gentlemen, I feel this is equally important with the wonderful address that you've just heard, because this represents the feeling of our audience and the things that they have on their mind. So, Governor, if you're ready, why, we will start off with a question about taxes. And, by the way, a lot of these questions refer to the same subject.
Can't understand that.
The question is, how will the withholding of state income taxes accomplish any greater increase in revenue than the requirements of an employer's statement of wages paid?
How will the withholding of state income taxes accomplish any greater increase of revenue than the requirement of an employer's statement of wages paid? Well, I can only tell you that I can only answer the question as I did in my talk, that the people whose withholding tax will be sent into the Treasury of the state of California are people that are now not paying their taxes. These people, some that don't pay, some that leave the state. That's where the increase of $58 million that I spoke of will come from.
Now we get over to a different subject, and we have a lot of people here who will be interested in this because of their profession. The question is, Republican lawyers know almost as much law as Democratic lawyers. This is an assumption. How many Republican judges have you appointed, and how many Democrats?
Well, after 20 years of Republican administration, it took me a few years to catch up on what had happened beforehand. But as a matter of fact, I statistically looked into this, and I've appointed about one-third Republican and about two-thirds Democrat. I may be a little bit high. For example, in the Los Angeles Superior Court in the last 60 days, three of the four appointments were Republicans. To the appellate courts, when I made the appointments, there were, I can't tell you how many Republicans and how many Democrats. Let me tell you this. In the selection of the judges that I appoint, I naturally come in closer contact with those that are with me in a political campaign. But political party is not the criteria that I use in the selection of judges. I want to know, first, is he a scholar? Number two, is he a good lawyer? Number three, is he a good human being? And then number four, I'll look and see if he's a Republican or a Democrat.
Now, this takes a somewhat more charitable viewpoint. It is, regarding the proposed California to Chile aid program, will you please comment on its objectives, organization, and method?
Well, of course, there's been tremendous criticism of the foreign aid program for many, many years under both administrations. It's a very difficult thing to administer. So the President of the United States, with people in the White House, took a look at the topography and the geography and the economics of Chile, and then they looked at California and the great work that our farmers in this state have done. So they thought that it would be a little closer union between the state of California and the nation of Chile. So the president asked me whether or not I'd be interested. I called in the University of California. I called in some of our biggest farmers in the state. I called in the people in our water resources, and they said they were very, very interested in this program. I met with the Chilean ambassador back in Washington a week ago, and he's enthusiastic, and we've sent a task force down there under this Alliance for Progress, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to enlist businessmen, farmers, to go down there for a month. We'll outline a program. We don't intend to move ahead in this thing until we know where we're going. The program will be paid for by the foreign aid program of the federal government. It will be a great experiment, and that's all that it will be. But we intend in here in California to give it everything that we can. And I know that I'll be able to call upon the best brains of the state of California to give up some of their time and energy to go down there for a period of a month or 2 months to try to do something for one of our friendly neighbors.
This question refers to water, and there are a lot of questions on water. And this one is, do you approve of Mr. Warney's present handling of the water bonds?
Well, we haven't sold any water bonds at all, so there hasn't been any real handling of them yet. We've been able to do all of the building that we've been doing up to the present moment out of the Tideland oil revenues that we received as a result of the case of Alabama, Rhode Island versus California, and the action of the Congress of the United States in returning it to us. So Mr. Warren's handling of the water bonds has been absolutely perfect up to the present moment.
While we're on the matter of bonds, here's another one. Would you comment on the use of revenue bonds to supplement water project bonds?
The situation is this. We've committed, at the time of the water bond fight and during the period it was going through the legislature, and I made many a speech in trying to put this water bond program over, that we would commit the Tideland oil revenues, the use of one resource, that we would commit it to another resource, water. We have now discovered that we have about $1 billion in new revenues coming out of the Long Beach oil fields. This is the conservative estimates by the largest oil companies in the United States. We will obtain, it's estimated, $1 billion over the next 30 to 35 years. The water program will support itself under proper financing. It's a good project. The pricing of the water project must yield enough to take care of our bond interest funding problems. It must take care of all the interest charges. It must take care of some of the recreation of the state of California. The question is, should we commit all of these funds, not knowing that we had this $1 billion to water, or should we relieve some of the present-day taxpayers in a self-financing project that will be paid for by the water users of our state over a period of the next 35 years, and use this for another great natural resource, to wit, education in the state of California, that will relieve you taxpayers of some of the burden that you have. There's no reason why you should pay the burden of a project that will be used by generations later on. So as a result of that, under the direction of the outstanding fiscal experts of the United States, and we've paid them good money, they've recommended that we use revenue bonds on power revenues during the period that we have the excess power. We won't need the power until we start pumping the water over the Tehachapis, and that won't come about until probably 77 or 78. It'll take us that long to get it down. I may be a little bit wrong on those dates. But the point is that there will be revenue out of the as a byproduct of Feather River Dam long before we have to use that power. So what we want to do is, under an old statute, use those revenue bonds, pay them off with these power revenues, extend the project a little while longer, but make it self-liquidating, and use some of the money Tideland oils to take care of what I call a great natural resource, the youth of our state. It's been presented to the Water Commission of the state of California. I have not personally committed myself to this as yet, but I would be less than frank with you if, in weighing the considerations, I didn't think this was a good thing to do.
This question refers to a topic that I think is one of your things close to your heart and before the legislature. What evidence do you have that capital punishment is not a deterrent to capital crime?
For 7 years, I was district attorney of San Francisco. 8 years, I was attorney general of this state. And every single one of those cases, and the Honorable Justice of the Supreme Court will tell you that never at any time did we do anything other than our duty in seeking to have these cases sustained by the appellate courts during the period that I was attorney general. I think there have been 46 cases that I've studied since I've been governor in these clemency hearings. We have a large book where contained within that book is the life history of every single one of these individuals. And I have not seen a single solitary case looking at the background of these individuals where capital punishment has been any deterrent whatsoever. In every single one of these cases, you can see the background, you can see the whole situation, and you can see other things that have led to this person being over there in condemned row. To me, it's an absolute degrading thing for human beings, individually or collectively, to take human life. It is justifiable, of course, during time of war. It's justified in self-defense. But when there is no causal relationship between the exercise of the death penalty and the deterrent of crime, then I say to you that to a governor who's also had experience in law enforcement, who's seen more of these cases than any man in the state of California from a standpoint of watching them, who first believed in capital punishment and changed his mind, that I should be given a chance for a period of 4 years at any rate to prove that life imprisonment without possibility of parole will be a greater deterrent, because now we think that capital punishment deters, and for that reason we don't do other things that we should do. Look at the interminable delays in these cases. And I'm not criticizing the courts. I'm not criticizing Justice Judge Carter for what he did the other day, and I tried to make it very clear. But here it is, 7 years where these people have been in condemned row. My friends, if justice cannot produce a more certain punishment and a quicker punishment than that, I say we should try something else.
In line with the Commonwealth Club's policy of getting all of the facts, this question is, what's so subversive about the Birchers that they should be investigated? Are you going to investigate the ADA?
I'll investigate the ADA if they state that the Chief Justice of the United States and the former President of the United States, Republican Dwight Eisenhower, is a conscious agent of the Communistic Party. I'll do it when they carry on a campaign. I won't investigate it in the sense that I will deprive them of their right to petition their government or do whatever they want to do. But I will try to produce the facts that people that send in these letters are acting upon complete lack of information in situation. That's all I want to find out. I think the Birchers and the ADA and everybody else has a complete right to do anything they want to do in this democracy of ours with respect to saying what they want to say and everything else. But by the same token, I think we have the right to get the facts of a situation and bring it out into the light of day. And that's all I want to do.
We have so many questions concerning the subject of taxation that I want to read a couple of them for the governor. We'll try and combine them a little bit. Will the withholding tax be put to a general vote of the people? And if not, why not? And the second question is, if I pay 1 3/4 years taxes in 1 year, is this a tax increase?
I don't see how you can put any tax increase to the vote of the people. although we've done it in the school bond elections, and two-thirds of the, in a great many cases, the people realizing the need have voted for it. But to the administration of government must be carried on through the legislature, except in great policy questions and things like that. I don't see how you can do that. The whole government would come to a close. You have 80 assemblymen. You have 40 state senators that you elect and represent, that represent you. And I assure you that they respond to the pressures of people and to the arguments that are made. So I don't think that a withholding tax will go to a vote of the people. If you pay 1 3/4 year taxes in 1 year, is this a tax increase? Well, it could be a tax increase, depending upon semantics, depending upon the word that you may use in that connection. But let me point out this to you. In that year, you will pay, of course, in 1964, you will pay your tax of 1963. Then in July of 1964, you will at that period begin paying on a monthly basis if the withholding tax goes into effect. And then in April of 1965, you'd have to file a return for the 6 months of the year of 1963, and then 25% of that is refunded. You'll have to judge that for yourself. The point is that I want to make clear that the only commitment I made to the people of this state was that there would be no increase in 63-64 budget. I was specifically asked the question on Meet the Press, what will happen in 64-65 and 66-67? And I said I can make no commitments in connection with that. And I say to you, if the withholding tax is not adopted, there will have to be higher income taxes or higher sales tax or higher cigarette tax or some other tax, and then watch the people on a tax program that someone may suggest, and let's see if we get any disagreement on that one.
We're still on taxes. This one I'm unable to comprehend. Perhaps you can, Governor. It says, if you want real economy, why don't you favor the painful instead of the painless taxes? I didn't know there were anything taxes painless. And the second one is, by closing the tax gap, don't you mean raising additional money, whether you call it extra or new taxes or whatever? How can you close the gap without extra payments from the taxpayer?
Well, the way that answering the real economy, you answered my question for me. There are no painless taxes that I know of. It's awfully rough on all of us on April 15th to sit down there and sign them out. And if that's painless to some of you, why, I'm very happy to know that. I've never read that in the papers. It is an easier, the pay-as-you-go tax will be easier in some respects, but it's not painless under any circumstance. By closing the gap, don't you mean raising additional money, whether you call it extra or new taxes or whatever? We really, believe me when I tell you, we do try to keep down the cost of government in California. And we are not doing all the things that we should do. I listened to a speech I read it in the papers. One of the state senators accused us of economy in the mental hospitals. Dr. Blaine is after us at all times to give him more money. You heard Dr. Kerr say that the 5% increase would not be enough to bring the great professors out here. The chancellor of the state colleges has been with me. The state employees will be beaten at my back on a greater salary increase than we've recommended. These are things that you have to study. We are not moving ahead in new programs this year but there are some new programs that you really have to move into. You take in the field of mental health. We now know that we can get those people out of these state institutions. But it takes psychiatric care. It takes psychiatric technicians. It takes new drugs. It takes bringing them back to a home and placing them close to their loved ones. These things are not cheap. We know that the narcotic addict can be under this rehabilitation program that we have, that he can be, I don't want to say cured because I want to be accurate, but I think he can be helped. Let me put it that way. It's much cheaper to keep them in the prisons and the penitentiaries. But that doesn't do, but we are working with those people. We're trying to give them care and attention. We're hospitalizing them at the present moment. There are new things in government. Hot dogs used to cost a nickel, now they're a quarter. I mean, it's the same thing in government. I think you have to ask yourself on these taxes, what are you getting? I have not, except in the field of social welfare, and maybe in the schools and colleges for a tuition fee, I have not seen any real from the opposite party in the last campaign where we had the tough political situation in 1962 where the Republicans justifiably wanted to make the Democratic governor look bad, and they took that budget and they went over it and they had experts come over it. When they got all through, they had $1.5 million more in it than the budget that I sent down to them. Now that's the situation you have up there in Sacramento. Ask yourself, is the public sector of the economy doing a good job? Don't only say, are we paying too much taxes? I think that there's a terrible tendency to downgrade our government. I'm not talking about me or the state of California. I think you see it nationally. I think you see it locally. I think that intelligent, hard-hitting criticism, but there must be alternatives. You just can't be against things.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry, but we have run out of time. We only got halfway through the questions. We did take a fair average of the questions that were asked, and Governor Brown answered them frankly and forthrightly. And, Governor, we are grateful to you for coming over and giving us this very forthright and informative discussion. The meeting is adjourned.
This is Stuart Richardson Ward, and across the microphone from me sits Governor Edmund G. Pat Brown, who just addressed the Commonwealth Club of California here in the Gold Ballroom of the Sheraton Palace Hotel in San Francisco. His topic was the legislative program and the state's economy. Pat, if I may call you that again, you referred to the fact, and thank you so much for it, that the Commonwealth Club for 60 years has been trying to study the state problems and to help in their solution in the various fields such as budgeting. And incidentally, may we brag that we're the fathers of the budget law, the governor's budget law, whereby that has to be passed before the legislators can make other appropriations.
Well, I can tell you that if we didn't have the budget that you fought so hard for, that the task of the governor would be almost impossible. The Commonwealth Club justified its existence alone in the work that you did in preparing the law for the preparation of the California budget. We have countries and states from all over the Union coming out here to copy our budget system in our state. And the Commonwealth Club first proposed this some 30 years ago under C.C. Young, wasn't it?
That's right. And the late assistant to Goethals in building the Panama Canal, our club president in 1919, the late C.E. Grunsky, who was also city engineer in San Francisco, once said, "We talk about all sorts of problems in this club, but he says only one real problem in this state." He says, "That's water." And you led into that, Pat, today in your talk.
Yes, I did. In connection with the water program, of course, for years there was a real stalemate up there in Sacramento. The North and the South couldn't agree. All of the water's in the North, and 60% of the people are south of the Hatchapes. So 4 years ago when I came in, after 8 years as Attorney General, I had an idea as to how we could solve this. We had the California Water Program that Governors Warren and Knight had both worked on, and we put it through. Now, just within the last week, the Supreme Court has authorized the sale of the bonds by validating them in a Supreme Court action. We're moving ahead on the Feather River Reservoir. We're moving ahead on the San Luis Reservoir. We have the aqueduct started. We're already delivering water to deficit areas in the north. So the California Water Program is well on its way. It's well financed, and we'll move ahead with it.
Thank you, Pat. And there's a second great problem, which I was going to say is second only to water, but it's perhaps even above water because it refers to our human resources, and that is education. You struck a new note on it today, Pat, as to how we stack up compared with any other state in the Union on our educational institutions.
I don't think there's any other state in the Union. I know there isn't, or any other nation in the world, that has started 9 new institutions of higher learning that will eventually be as big as the biggest that we have in the state of California at the present time. That's 23 to 25,000 students. And we've started 9, 6 new state colleges, 3 new universities of California. We're implementing the medical schools in both San Francisco and Los Angeles. And in addition to that, we're building another dental school and a new medical school in San Diego. And this costs money, my friend. And this is one of the reasons that the taxes of California are not going down, despite the great increase in our economy.
And ever since the days of 49, Pat, there have always been a few people around, even the old gold diggings, who used to just tap their fingers to the forehead and say, poor so-and-so, they're off their rocker. But you're doing something about these people who are off their rocker, as we used to call it.
Yes, we certainly are. I brought Dr. Dan Blaine, who's one of the outstanding psychiatrists of the nation, and he moved into a real new theory. Don't put people in these warehouses for mentally ill, but get them out, that they can be cured. Modern medicine is doing a tremendous job. So we have, despite an increase in population of about 2 million plus, we have in the state of California 2,500 fewer in our mental institutions than we had when I took over 4 years ago. And this costs money, too. Now, I don't want it to be understood that we've solved mental health in the state of California. We're not doing all that we could or all that we should, but we're doing all that we can afford at the present time, and we're going to try to take care of as many of these unfortunates as we can. But to cut 2,500 down in view of the increase in population is a pretty good job, and I think we should be given A for effort in that one.
And close to your interest, Governor, in the matter of mental balance comes the subject of drugs. You have an interest in that too, sir?
We've had a real narcotic problem in California for many years. We have we're close to the Mexican border. We have five or six ports where people come from the Far East, where it's very easy to get those drugs. And we know that narcotics is one of the greatest crime producers that we have. We found difficulty in doing anything about the addict. We found difficulty in proving our case. We'd get them, but heroin is very easy to conceal. It became very difficult. So we're trying to treat it not as a criminal problem. We're treating it as a health problem, the same way we do with a person with an infectious disease. They must be quarantined. So we're quarantining the narcotic addict under hospital commitments rather than under penal commitments. We're not punishing them. We're treating them. This is not an inexpensive program either, and the taxpayers of the state have to do these things. But in the long run, they won't see the benefits probably during the next 2 or 3 years. But in the long run, we won't have the police problem, we won't have the court problem that we have with narcotics, because we're not going to ever stop it any more than we're going to stop death or worry or anything like that. But we're going to cut it down, and that's what we're doing. So we have a new conservation center, a camp down at Norco in Riverside County, and we're building that. And there we commit these people on a basis where it's involuntary. They can't get out when they want, any more than a person that has infectious tuberculosis can get out and infect others. And the Supreme Court recently held that law constitutional, too. So you can see we're moving ahead in that direction.
And among your many accomplishments, Pat, you once also had an incidental or kind of a miscellaneous catch-all of things which you said were, as you put it, pumping vitality into the economy.
Yes, we've done a lot of things. I'm afraid I sound boastful, but I think the people should know it, because I have to explain where their tax dollars are going. We have the first master plan for highway development, the first air pollution laws, the first economic development agency to draw new business to our state, the first comprehensive state program for cancer research, the first laws to permit retraining of workers in this day of automation. All of these things we're doing in the state. And I don't know who would really recommend getting rid of any of those, and these cost money, too.
How about the occupation of so many of our people here in the state, Pat, and that is farms and retail selling?
Farm income will exceed $3 billion again this year. Retail sales are up over 8%. We reach a new high almost every single solitary month. Of course, we have more people. Employment reached a new all-time high in January. We expect it to reach a new all-time high in February. Unemployment is still too high. We're over 6% in the month of February, but it's less than it was, not very much, about 0.3% down from February of 1962. This is progress, because we have a great many people in our state that come to California because they've lost their job and they haven't the skills in the East or in the South or in the Midwest or from the farms. So we have a national problem here in California that we're solving without very much national help.
Well, you were talking to an audience of among our 10,600 club members. There are many who are professional men, but a very large group, of course, are businessmen. And you talk business with them today, Pat. You started in hitting on such things as financing current expenses from capital funds, and you talked about the absence of a deficit. What was that you said?
Well, here in the state of California, I must present under the Constitution a budget. The budget contains all of the monies that we expect to spend for a period of 1 year. and I'm constitutionally mandated to state where this money is coming from. When I came over, when I came in as governor, they'd been using capital funds, bond monies, to take care of current expenses. That's all been eliminated now. We pay our current expenses out of current revenues. We build our capital structures out of our bond money, out of our investment. But these great institutions will be used for 100 or 150 years, and so we're doing that by bonds. And we'll spread the cost of this over a period of 40 to 50 years and maybe even longer than that as time goes on, because there's no reason why this generation should pay the bill for a generation yet to come. Every large corporation is financing their capital improvements by the sale of bonds or preferred stock or some other form of financing. And we, the state of California, are doing the same. But we're paying our salaries, we're paying our teachers, we're paying for our food. We're doing that out of our current revenues. And we're making some capital expenditures, too, out of our revenues. For example, the water, the San Luis Dam and the Feather River Dam are paid for out of revenues that we receive from our tide lands. But pretty soon, we may want to change that and commit some of that money to another great natural resource, the young people of our state.
You called attention, Pat, to your promises that you made before election, which very few politicians dare to do. And you called attention to the fact this was your fifth budget message, and also that you had gotten along without new taxes. And you've made some interesting comments in comparing New York, the second state of the union, as you well expressed it today, with California as regards to whether or not there was or was not enacted new laws or new legislation in the form of taxation.
The governor must present an annual budget to the people of the state, as I just explained. During the campaign, I said there would be no new taxes in 63-64. And the way I planned to avoid new taxes was to do away with the installment payment of taxes without interest. So as a result of that, in 63-64, I've asked for no new taxes. I have asked that they pay their taxes on April 15th rather than to, April 15th, 1964, rather than to pay it on deferred payments of some 9 months, as we're doing at the present time. This they will have to do in 1964, but there are no new taxes. No one that's not paying taxes now will be asked to pay taxes. We're not broadening the base. We are accelerating the payments. Then in 64-65, which is the budget that will be submitted to the legislature in January of 1964, at that time, we will have to go into withholding taxes or have new taxes. I think withholding taxes that will catch some $58 million in additional taxes from people who are not paying their taxes. People that come into the state of California today that and then work for 6 or 8 months and then leave. They never file an income tax return. And then just think of this. In a state with population increase of 600,000, they come in January, they go to school in January. Their children get the benefit of our services. If they need health care and they come under our categoric aids, they move into that situation, we give that to them. They use our roads, they use our police, they use our courts. But they don't pay for it for a period of 15 months. In other words, you come in January, you don't pay your taxes for 63 until April of 1964. So a person coming in January of 63, and I hope I'm making myself clear, they'll pay no taxes until April of 64. Well, in a state that's static, you can move along, you can take care of that because people die and only new people take their place. But in a state that has 600,000 new people every year, we must have a pay-as-you-go tax program in this state. And I'm sure that the legislature, when they weigh the alternatives, will come to the same conclusion.
Pat, I'm still waiting to hear what you're going to say about Nelson D. Rockefeller Jr. in New York and how he handled
the same problem. I almost forgot about the other member of my union. Nelson Rockefeller was running for re-election, too, and he made a commitment, but he went a little bit further in his commitment than I did. I don't know whether he had to make more commitments than I did to get re-elected. But he said there'd be no new taxes for 4 years. Then he came along and he suggested an increase in license fees and in beverage taxes. He calls these licenses, though. But previous to this year, they were always called taxes. And the New York Times, in their article, said that they believe that the proposals of the governor were good. But he said, don't try to fool the people and say they're not taxes.
Pat, in discussing the tax situation, you suggested that there is need for a service of the courts, the schools, and so forth. And it's got to be paid somehow, along the line of the old saying that the best tax is that which gets the most feathers from the goose with the least squawking.
Well, it's always the balancing of evils up there in Sacramento. There's not one solution to any of these problems, and we have to sit down in the quiet of the executive offices with the aid and assistance of business and labor and the experts on our economy, and we have to make decisions, and that's exactly what we do. And then we give them to the legislature, they have to weigh them, they have to listen to the arguments, and they come up with conclusions. I feel confident that the position that we've taken is good. We're trying to run an economical administration. We run an a state that's efficient, again, thanks to the Commonwealth Club and some of the things that they did in the budgeting that we talked about. But unfortunately, when it's with a state that's growing, that provides the services that we do, you're going to have new taxes or new form of taxes probably in the years ahead. Although we might even be able to avoid that because the economy of California is so dynamic.
Thank you very much, Governor Edmund G. Pat Brown, for yet another talk to the Commonwealth Club of California. And now may I announce that next week, same station, same time, I'll be interviewing for you Brigadier General J.D. Hittle, U.S. Marine Corps retired, Director of National Security and Foreign Affairs for the Veterans of Foreign Wars. His topic, Communist Strategy in Cuba and the Far East.